roads expected. And tomorrow, patchy fog early, mostly cloudy, temperatures 22 to 28.
Hello, I'm Neil Coxall.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. Coming up on As It Happens.
Uncertain future. A political analyst tells us his fellow Venezuelans are still in shock after the U.S. attack and still processing the fact that Nicolas Maduro is now a prisoner in New York. And they're still no closer to knowing what all of that means for democracy in their country.
And Force of Hobbit. A bar owner spends nearly 11 straight hours reading The Hobbit out loud to his patrons, voices and all, in the name of charity. And he says the money he donated at the end makes him shyer he did the right thing.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. On the Rivers, our volunteer host and mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music weekdays at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. If you provide child care for a friend or family member, there are educational resources and supplies available through the Indigenous nonprofit All Nations Rise. Items include books, trainings, first aid kits, and more. Learn more at allnationsrise.com/FFN. Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji invites you to intercultural creative circles on most Wednesdays, now through March from 11 to 3. Bring your current art project or start a new one with your own materials. Grand Rapids Tax Aid seeks volunteers for the upcoming tax season. They are looking for people to prepare taxes and those who would rather help in other ways. Email taxaidgr@gmail.com. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is The National with The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness.
Explain it. Oh, any other way.
And that's The National with The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
uncharted territory. A political analyst in Venezuela tells us there is an eerie quiet and a feeling of disbelief as it sinks in that Nicolas Maduro is no longer in charge.
From Caracas to the courtroom, the ousted Venezuelan president was brought to a Manhattan courthouse today in shackles as questions swirl about the legalities of his capture.
He means business. Ontario's Premier Doug Ford's return to office mandate takes full effect this week, despite concern and backlash from public sector workers.
Running dry after the second major water main break in as many years, Calgary Mayor Jeremy Farkas is asking Calgarians to conserve water so that the city doesn't run out.
Reading between the lines, after spending nearly 11 hours reading The Hobbit to his patrons, a bar owner in St. John's tells us the endeavor and the money it raised were totally worth it.
And game theory. New research helps uncover exactly how the throat colors of the side-blotched lizard evolved to help win over mates, a process scientists likened to a game of rock, paper, scissors. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that's dying to know what tips the scales. It was a sight that most Venezuelans never imagined they'd witness. People across the country rushed online, trying to stream video of ousted President Nicolas Maduro being transported under heavy guard on his way to a New York courthouse today. He pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking charges, saying, "I am innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man, the president of my country." Mr. Maduro was captured by U.S. forces during a dramatic raid on Caracas on Saturday. Benigno Alcalcón is a political analyst. We reached him in Caracas.
Benigno, I wonder how it felt to you personally to see these images of Nicolas Maduro being led into a courthouse in the United States.
The situation is, you know, very strange and it's incredible for people in Venezuela. Starting for the day of the United States attack in Venezuela, okay? People were expecting that something will happen, but nobody was really believing that it would be possible, no? Today, the reaction is almost the same. When they are looking at the scene, at the reality and what is going on, this, you know, looks like a science fiction movie, no? It's something that is hard to believe.
What are people doing? Are they staying indoors? Are they going about, you know, their normal daily lives?
No, at this time, no. People are very scared about what is going on. The situation of repression in Venezuela has been very hard. So people are very scared about what is going on, what will happen next. And people today are closing their houses. Few businesses are open and functioning, but most of the people are staying at home, looking at the news, trying to be informed about what is going on, what happened. As a matter of fact, the schools didn't open today. Last night, we received an email from our schools telling us that, you know, because of the situation in the country, the children won't be in class until next week. So, you know, the situation for everybody is strange. People are very scared about what will happen next.
What does it look like in your neighborhood, on your street?
The only basic services and businesses are open right now, like, you know, drug stores and the food markets and these kind of things. But the rest of business are closed at this time.
And in terms of military presence? or police presence?
No, there's no, around my neighborhood, mm-hmm. there's no military presence, but people in the social networks are saying that in some places there's people in the, you know, in the street checking the cars, asking people where are they going, mm-hmm. and this kind of things, but not in the whole city. In my neighborhood, there's no military or police presence right now.
You wrote just at the end of last year that you were expecting that the U.S., the pressure tactics from the U.S. might lead to what you described as a negotiated exit for Maduro. This military action and what has actually happened, did it shock you?
Yes, it is. But on the other side, as you know, I'm working at the university and I am a researcher in democracy and democratic transitions, no? So we have the impression that both parties, the United States and the government in Venezuela, are taking a pragmatic approach to this situation. And maybe the United States are expecting that this government is, you know, working in easing a transition process in Venezuela. And on the other hand, the government on this side maybe are expecting that they are able to negotiate a solution with the United States or trying to move any decision in order to gain time and to stay in power for more time.
How are the people you've been speaking with there reacting to how all of this happened? Unilateral U.S. action, Donald Trump, the U.S. president's statements that the United States is going to, quote, run Venezuela?
Most of the people, 85% of the people in Venezuela, desire for many time ago a democratic transition in Venezuela. And the reality is that at this time, people don't care about what will be the, you know, the way to reach that goal, no? And maybe people are thinking that, you know, the important thing here is to change the government, and after that, we'll see what happened and how we can resolve the next problem, no?
Our listeners are going to hear a conversation a little bit later in the show about Delcy Rodriguez, the interim leader in Venezuela right now, was quite outspoken about what the U.S. did initially. Today, much more conciliatory, saying, you know, they could work on a, quote, cooperative agenda, unquote. What did you make of that shift in tone?
I think that people in the government are scared, too, after the demonstration of power a few hours ago. I think that everybody in the government and in the military knows very well that they don't have the capacity to deal with this kind of situations. Maybe they are willing to cooperate because they know that they don't have any alternative.
What does this ultimately mean for Maria Corina Machado, Edmundo Gonzalez, and those, their supporters?
People who are supporting Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez, that are most of the people in Venezuela, they are not happy with the expression of Donald Trump, okay? They think that Donald Trump was unfair with Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez, and they expect that this situation will be correct, and Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez will be the next government in Venezuela. Let's see what happens. I think that, you know, that the government of the United States are trying to put everything under certain conditions to be able to put the elected government in power. Let's see what happens.
Benigno, I appreciate this. Please take care. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Benigno Alarcón is a political analyst. We reached him in Caracas, Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro and his wife face a number of drug and weapons charges, including, quote, narco-terrorism. During the arraignment in New York today, the couple pleaded not guilty. Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan and a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. We reached her in Ann Arbor.
Barbara, our last guest in Venezuela, as our listeners heard, said there's really this sense of shock and disbelief to see Maduro enter a courthouse in the United States and to believe that he's actually out of power at this moment and out of Venezuela. What did you think as you saw those images?
Kind of the same. I think the thing that is most disturbing from a U.S. legal perspective is respect for the rule of law. I know that there are many people who are cheering the departure of Nicolas Maduro. Some will say it's good for the people of Venezuela or the world order. But what's so important about a country that upholds the rule of law is doing things the right way. And so in this instance, I think people are unanimous in recognizing that this abduction violates the UN Charter about taking aggression against a sovereign nation and abducting a sitting head of state.
The U.S. government does not see Maduro as the legitimate head of Venezuela. He clearly asserted in court that he is, quote, president of my country, unquote. From a legal standpoint, Barbara, can a foreign head of state be put on trial in the United States?
No. A head of state enjoys sovereign immunity. U.S. courts have recognized that. And a head of state cannot be brought to court on criminal charges in the United States. However, I think the U.S. will take the position that he is not the legitimate head of state. And it'll be interesting to see whether a court is willing to make its own findings onto the legitimacy of his presidency, or whether it instead will decide that this is just not something that is judiciable by a court, and that the court must instead accept the recognition of the executive branch. So I imagine that'll be a motion that gets filed by Nicolas Maduro, and we'll see how that shakes out in court. But, you know, if the United States can just say, I don't recognize you as the head of state, does that allow it really to arrest anyone and thereby just completely neutralize this sovereign immunity doctrine? That's the part that makes this, I think, a little bit unsettling.
Maduro and his wife Celia Flores have both pleaded not guilty to the charges they are facing. The Associated Press is reporting a little bit on the indictment, saying that it says Venezuelan officials work directly with a gang called Tren de Aragua, but that a U.S. intelligence assessment published in the spring that looked at input from 18 intelligence agencies found no coordination between Tren de Aragua and the Venezuelan government. Again, that's from the Associated Press. Barbara, what is your assessment of what you've seen of the indictment so far?
Well, it's difficult to know until you see the case in court. The government, of course, will have to prove all of its allegations to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Ordinarily, I think we would say that an indictment has a presumption of regularity because a grand jury must necessarily have reviewed the evidence and found probable cause to believe that a crime had been committed. So every assertion in that indictment had to have been reviewed by a grand jury and approved. However, in recent months, I think I've become a little skeptical about the way the Trump administration is using its criminal justice powers. We saw indictments filed against Attorney General of New York Letitia James and former FBI Director James Comey, both of which got dismissed on procedural grounds. But both of those cases seem to lack the kind of regularity that I have come to expect. The only thing that gives me more confidence than I might otherwise have in these charges is the fact that they were initially filed in March of 2020. They were renewed in a superseding indictment with some fresh allegations and the addition of Maduro's wife. But they essentially go back to these charges filed in 2020 in the first Trump administration, when we had a different attorney general, William Barr, and a different U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, the largely respected Jeffrey Berman. And so that makes me think that there's more than just thin air here.
Given the sovereign immunity issue that you mentioned, and also the concerns that international law may have been violated here in the way all of this played out and what the United States did in Venezuela over the weekend, how do you think the court will wrestle with all of that?
I imagine that there will be motions filed by the defense to throw out the charges, to suppress some of the evidence, to make a finding of sovereign immunity. That's likely to take many months to play out. But there is one aspect of this arrest that is likely, even if it's shocking to the international community and violates international law, probably will not result in a finding by the court of an illegal arrest. And that's because of a doctrine in the United States known as the Kerr Frisbee Rule. It's a name after a couple of cases by that name. But essentially what it says is if somebody ends up here in court and they're charged with a crime, the case can proceed against them even if their arrest was unlawful through kidnapping or abduction or some other means. I know that sounds shocking sometimes in a country that otherwise uses the Fourth Amendment rule to suppress evidence obtained in violation of unreasonable searches and seizures, but there is no suppressing of the body based on an illegal arrest. So even if that arrest was illegal under international law, it probably will not be an obstacle to the trial in the criminal case.
If Maduro were to win throughout this legal process, what do you imagine happening then?
Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? Because if he were to return to his country, would he resume the presidency? Would the United States instead try to cast him as an enemy combatant? We'll have to see what happens in that situation. But that has been done in other situations where people are deemed too dangerous to return to their country, held in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It's hard to imagine that the international community would tolerate that kind of detention, but that could be an option that the United States pursues if they don't want to see him return to power.
Barbara, I appreciate this. Thanks for coming back on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney and a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. She was in Ann Arbor. People will do all kinds of things for charity. Run excessive distances, hold bake sales, tolerate telethons, approach perfect strangers in the street asking for donations, read Tolkien aloud virtually nonstop for nearly 11 hours at a bar. Okay, maybe most people wouldn't do that last one. But for some reason, that's exactly what sprang to mind for Alan Bearns when he was looking for a way to make a difference this new year. Mr. Bearns is the owner of Aaron's Pub in St. John's. That's where we reached him.
Alan, what possessed you to take this on?
I like doing things that seem impossible or are beyond what I think I'm capable of. I discovered that this year I started hiking the East Coast Trail and I would go do hikes really beyond my ability, and I successfully completed them, and now it's winter and it's cold and I don't want to hike in the winter. So I said I want to read a book and see how long I can do it and see if I can do it in one sitting. And yeah, that's kind of it.
You needed to be indoors. You like to read. Why The Hobbit though?
The Hobbit, it's just a great story. It's accessible for anyone. It's, you know, it's one of the easier reads for Tolkien, and I'm just a really big fan of Tolkien. And when I was trying to figure this out, I noticed his birthday was January 3rd. It's something, you know, everyone can enjoy. Just a good story, just there and back again.
And beyond that, that love of that story and the personal commitment to challenge, you'd also seen changes in your neighborhood. What were you seeing that made you want to turn this into a charity event?
Yeah, I mean, I want to do a charity event because, you know, I used to do a lot of charity stuff in my teens and early 20s, and it's been an awful long time. And I just thought this was something fun that I could do with people and get a little money. And, you know, I live and breathe and work downtown St. John's, and, you know, it's changed. There's a lot more people that are hard up and need help. And frankly, I can't afford to give all the change that's asked for me when I'm walking to and from work. And there's a little organization in St. John's, Newfoundland called The Gathering Place that offers meal and shelter. So I said, if I'm going to read for 12 hours, I might as well see if I can get them some money.
What was the total amount of time you were reading? I've seen and heard a couple of different numbers. When you looked at the clock, when you turned the final page...
Well, I started a little after one, and I finished a quarter to, quarter to 11 or quarter to 12. Either way, I clocked it at 10 hours and 45 minutes.
Okay, not bad. Not easy, though. That's 95,000 words in a single sitting. What kind of, I mean, I'm sure you prepared for your hike when you did the East Coast Trail. What did you do to prepare for this?
Well, on the contrary, I never prepare for my hikes.
Okay.
People get very mad at me for that. And I did absolutely zero preparation for this. I literally put the post up 36 hours before it was going to start. That morning, I was just scrambling to get my AV equipment so I could live stream it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I didn't prepare my voice or anything. I started with like drinking a beer and a scotch. And then, you know, about 5-6 hours in, I switched strictly to green tea and honey. And my voice was gone. I should get a vocal coach after this if I try it again.
I mean, did you take breaks?
I made a little rule where, like, I could take a 5-minute break after every chapter for 19 chapters, but I ended up just taking 3 to 5 minute breaks,
yeah.
Just enough to, like, you know, go outside or just stretch my legs. I don't know. I guess I'm a pain. I like suffering or something. I don't know. But I didn't know it was preparation. I just winged it and I got through it. And the break times were probably like 20 minutes in total for the whole 11 hours.
I remember reading The Hobbit maybe in grade 7 or 8. You clearly love the story and know it well. You didn't prepare, but were there parts you were excited to read?
I was really excited to read the chapter where Bilbo meets Gollum. I mean, I think everyone does. I did try to do a little voices, but I did it differently. And there were certain passages that always touched me, like, it's a story about a guy going outside of his comfort zone and finding adventure. And that's kind of what this was for me a little bit, too.
We have a clip, actually, of part of the live stream featuring Gollum. People who've seen the films, you know Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
Clearly, you tried to, you know, no one can be Andy.
No.
So it's good, you know, it's good that you took your own ideas
yes.
to the character. But let's listen to it a bit.
Gollum got into his little boat and shot off from the island, while Bilbo was sitting on the brink, altogether flummoxed, and all the end of his way in his wits. Sunward came up Gollum and whispered and hissed. What the f*** is up?
Blessed!
There you go, that's my best friend.
Yeah, my
Gollum's the same guy, that's what you're dealing with.
Bless us and wash us, splash us, my precious. I take a choke feast. At least a tasty morsel it must make us, Gollum.
I heard the laughter there. What was the crowd like?
The crowd was great. One gentleman stayed for almost the bulk of it. I had a lot of friends and regulars and community people drop in and out. I also had like 20 or 30 people put their head in or look through the window
yeah.
and said, that's not for me, and walk straight away. But people were receptive. You know, people laughed at the funny parts. People...
Yeah.
You know, gasp at the, you know, the sadder parts and such. It was fun hearing people relay off what I was, you know, saying Tolkien's words.
In the end, what was the tally? What were you able to raise for the gathering place?
Oh, $1,422. So I just surpassed my goal of $1,379. The one is for the One Ring, the Rule Them All, and 3 is for the Elf Lords, and 7 for the... the dwarfs, and the 7 and the 9 for the mortal men doomed to die. I know I'm not getting that quote exactly right, but I only set that goal because it was a nice little metaphor for the rings and the fellowship of the rings. But I thought I'd make a couple $100. It felt great. I you know, that's a couple more meals and maybe another bed for a night for people. So it feels good. I've been riding that high for a couple days now.
Oh, that's nice. In the new year, Alan, I appreciate this. Thank you and happy new year.
Thank you very much, and Happy New Year to you.
Alan Bearns is the owner of Aaron's Pub in St. John's. That's where we reached him.
Okay, ready? Rock, paper, scissors. Rock, paper, or scissors? I don't know what that is.
It's a claw.
Claw. Rock, paper, scissors.
Claw!
I think you're going to get it. Oh, mics are on. We're on the air.
Okay. Okay. Sorry about that. Neil was just trying to help me get my head around the mating process of the side-blotched lizard. That sentence will make sense in just a bit. You see, in breeding season, male side-blotched lizards develop one of three colors in their general gullet area: yellow, orange, or blue, like a jaunty cravat, but also like the colors of rival teams. Each color is associated with a distinct mating strategy. The oranges are aggressive, fighting for as much territory and as many females as they can get. The blues claim a smaller territory, but work hard to defend it against invading oranges. The yellows are mellow, claiming no territory and simply sneaking into the territory of others and asking a female, "Hey, want to get out of here?" It's a process that scientists say is a biological version of rock, paper, scissors. Orange beats blue, blue beats yellow, yellow beats orange. And so, ultimately, no one color comes out on top. It's never been clear whether all this is the result of genetic differences or a response to their environment, but new research shows it's a bit of both, all of which is cool. But if I were going to pick a game for my mating rituals, it wouldn't be the most boring one of them all. Yeah, I said it. Then again, unlike humans, at least the lizards have been able to turn a pointless time waster of a game into something more reproductive. Here's Strange Advance with Love Games. Strange Advance with Love Games.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, the U.S. president is already lashing out at Venezuela's new and interim leader. A former Canadian ambassador tells us about Delcy Rodriguez.
And the last Walls. Minnesota governor and former vice presidential candidate Tim Walls says he has decided not to run for a third term amid a welfare scandal that has led to Donald Trump targeting the state's Somali community. Stay tuned. I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle.
And I'm Neil Kirkshall.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE-KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Michelle Bedford. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. If you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group the first Tuesday of every month at 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. You can try out snowshoes and kick sleds Saturday, January 10th from 10 to 2 at Lake Bemidji State Park. The park's artists and residents are wrapping up their final projects, and you can visit with them during this time as well. Light snacks provided. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens here on member-supported radio, KAXE, KBXE.
As Nicolas Maduro made his first appearance in a New York court today, a new leader in Venezuela was formally sworn in. At least for now, Maduro ally Delcy Rodriguez is the interim leader of the country. She's been the vice president since 2018. As she was sworn in today, she said, quote, "I come with sorrow for the kidnapping of two heroes," unquote, referring to Mr. Maduro and his wife. It came after Ms. Rodriguez struck a more conciliatory tone and said she was willing to cooperate with the United States after previously calling this weekend's attack an atrocity. Ben Rosewell was Canada's ambassador to Venezuela from 2014 to 2017. He's currently a consultant with Catalyze 4. We reached him in Toronto.
Ben, the U.S. president, as you know, has said his country is going to run Venezuela. Just last night on Air Force One, Donald Trump said the U.S. is in charge of Venezuela. What is your sense of the reality there on the ground right now?
The United States is not in charge of what's happening on the ground in Venezuela. They have left no military presence whatsoever. And the woman who's taken over from Nicolas Maduro is just as committed a socialist and just as awful a human rights abuser as Nicolas Maduro. And she seems to be very much in charge of what's happening on the ground. So the Venezuelan government is intact in spite of what the United States did on Saturday.
And do you envision Delcy Rodriguez remaining in that position for long? You know, Donald Trump has been lobbying sort of threats at her as well, saying that she needs to get in line. She went from speaking out against what the U.S. had done to being more conciliatory. Do you think that there's any chance she is not going to stay in that role?
Well, there's a fundamental contradiction in what Delcy Rodriguez seeks and what the United States seeks. So it's really hard to imagine them remaining in any kind of stasis right now. Either the United States is going to give up and let Delcy Rodriguez remain in power, or they might have some kind of action to go after her as they had gone after Maduro. She is about the most committed socialist you could possibly imagine, and virulently anti-American. Removing just one person from a government doesn't change the nature or the orientation of that government. And so I just don't see how Delcy Rodriguez and the United States could ever possibly work together.
And you've met Delcy Rodriguez in person as ambassador.
I have, yeah.
You've described, you know, the meetings that she would hold with other ambassadors, dozens of them. What would you want our listeners to know about those meetings?
Well, she's a rabid ideologue. I mean, the meetings were quite entertaining. She would bring all of the ambassadors of every single country, about 70 of us from across the world, into a grand hall and close the doors and then harangue us for sometimes as much as an hour and 15 minutes about the great socialist revolution and about the perfidy of the United States and how it's a great thing that there's a new multipolar order arising where Venezuela and Russia and North Korea and all of its friends could oppose the United States. But it showed to us, to me and my fellow ambassadors from the other countries, that what we're dealing with is someone who's extremely passionate, not particularly strategic, but someone who would put her life on the line for the success of the socialist revolution.
So what did you make then of that shift in tone? What's behind that, going from, you know, saying this is alarming, you know, how the U.S. has moved in and done this, to then, you know, saying that they could potentially cooperate? What's the strategy?
Yeah, from her perspective, I mean, she runs the government. She's in full control of Venezuela right now. She's got the loyalty of the army. She's got the loyalty of the Ministry of the Interior and all the spy agencies, all the intelligence agencies. They have instilled a climate of fear on the streets of Caracas. If you talk to people on the ground there, they're stockpiling food and trying to minimize any kind of movement because the socialist government that's been abusing their rights for so many years is still very much in charge. So against that backdrop, what What would be the smart thing for her to say to the United States would be to say, you know, whatever pleases Donald Trump, to confuse them, or to allow her and the socialist government just to carry on as they were doing before Nicolas Maduro was taken away. I assume that there'll be people in Washington that won't stand for this and will want to renew their military aggression against Venezuela. But for the time being, if she can hold that off by saying the right things to the United States, then it seems like the correct move for her to take.
What will this mean, do you think, for Maria Corina Machado and Edmundo Gonzalez and their supporters?
Well, the people of Venezuela have expressed their support by a massive margin in the election that was held in 2024 for Edmundo Gonzalez and then Maria Corina Machado, who's really the power behind the whole democracy movement.
She was barred from running, which is why he ran. Yeah,
that's right. She asked the people of Venezuela to vote for Gonzalez, and they did in these massive numbers. So a country can really only be stable in the long term if the people of the country accept the government and collaborate with it. And that's never going to happen with the socialist government. Whether it's Nicolas Maduro, Delcy Rodriguez, or whoever the next guy is, there won't be stability until Venezuela returns to democracy. The United States, if it wants a stable Venezuela that can do business with, should be encouraging Edmundo Gonzalez to fly from Madrid, where he's based right now, to Caracas and take the reins of power. It's the only way really to achieve stability in Venezuela is to allow the candidate that's been selected by the people of Venezuela to take office.
Do you think that the United States cares about that?
The U.S. appears to be primarily motivated by dominance and by personal gain for the president and the people close to the president, which is a worrisome development. I mean, the United States itself is a source of great instability in the hemisphere right now. It is very unpredictable, given that they've deprofessionalized their foreign policy. As I've mentioned, it's a highly irrational and unpredictable decision-making process that's now there in the United States. It's not clear if they have a sense of what's right for America itself. They have a sense of what's right for Donald Trump. But it's a difficult period that the United States is going through right now. If we set the government of the United States aside and just talk about the U.S. as a country, yes, it has an interest in having a stable country on its borders. Venezuela has been the source of the single largest migration in human history in this hemisphere, sending 8 million refugees throughout the hemisphere. You would hope that the United States will one day have a government that wants Venezuela to be stable and for Venezuelans to return home.
Ben, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much for your interest in Venezuela. It's important that Canadians know what's happening in a country that's really very close to our own.
Ben Rosewell is a former Canadian ambassador to Venezuela and now a consultant with Catalyze 4. He's in Toronto. Only flush if you must. That is the message coming from Calgary's Emergency Management Agency today as the city's water system tries to recover from last week's massive pipe burst. As we told you then, 13 people had to be rescued from dramatic flooding, and parts of the city were left under a boil water advisory. The advisory has now lifted, but the city is still urging people to limit water use. Mayor Jeremy Farkas says Calgary will enter, quote, loss of life territory, where firefighting and emergency response may be compromised if people don't reduce their water use.
I think it's fair to say that we are living in a new normal. Right now under our streets, there is a ticking time bomb. This bear's paw feeder main served Calgarians for many years, but right now it is at end of life, and no amount of short-term fixes, no amount of patchwork will be able to get this back into a reliable condition. So we have to do absolutely everything that we can to address the immediate needs to fix it, but the medium-term and the long-term fix to this is both governance as well as building out that parallel line. So until this line line is fixed, this could potentially happen tomorrow after this is fixed. But make no mistake, the world we lived in yesterday, where water was something that we could take for granted, that does not exist anymore. Today, we are living in a different reality. Today, we are living in a new normal of water conservation.
The premier has said maybe the province should take over some responsibility for the water utility, talking about Calgarians' frustration and how she shares that. What do you make of the premier's idea of taking over some of the responsibility for what's happening?
I absolutely welcome that conversation in terms of if the province is looking to lean in with further resources to be able to help municipalities with, say, major water infrastructure in Alberta. It makes sense that more resources from them would have come with greater oversight and accountability.
What's the fail with this pipe?
Yeah, the pipe is failing because it's breaking down from the inside. Small cracks formed over time. There's water and salts from the soil that reach the steel wires inside the pipe, and those wires rusted, they weakened, and some have already failed. So this pipe, it cannot be made safe with patches. It has reached its end of life, and until it is fully replaced, it can fail again without warning, and that's why it is a ticking time bomb.
The matter that it's can fail without warning, like, a lot was made about the monitoring of the pipe since the last break. Why isn't that working? Why didn't we see this coming?
The type of failure that occurred this time around was very different from the type of failure that occurred the previous summer. So despite the fact that the pipe was busted both times, this was a new and different way for the pipe to be able to fail.
What do you mean?
Was not anticipated. If you look at the actual images, and I'm not the engineer, but you can see it was almost a clean break open, almost like a zipper, rather than a burst. So this was a type of break that was not anticipated, or at least the engineers were not prepared for it to break in this type of way. But we are going back to ground zero. We're going to ensure that we are doing absolutely everything possible. And ultimately, as mayor, I take responsibility for this.
Calgary Mayor Jeremy Farkas speaking with host Lauren McGuinness on CBC's Calgary Eye Opener. Tens of thousands of Ontario workers may have a worse-than-usual case of the Mondays. Starting today, Premier Doug Ford is forcing government employees back to the office full-time. The in-office days had already been ramped up to 3 or 4 days per week in the fall, but many are pushing back. Public servants say they haven't been consulted on the back-to-office order and that legitimate requests for at-home work accommodations have not been addressed. J.P. Hornick is president of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union. We reached them in Toronto.
J.P., the hybrid model has been a reality for a while. People have been going back to work, you know, more and more days through the week. This might add 1 or 2 more days for most workers. That sounds reasonable to a lot of people. You don't think so. Why?
The mandate that's been forced upon them is a return to office mandate. And the issue with it is a couple of fold. One, there's been no evidence presented that this will improve productivity, that it will do anything to improve the services that Ontarians rely on. But even more than that, there's not even space available in many of the cases. We know we've heard stories from many workers that the offices they were working in were renovated because the assumption was that there wouldn't be a full return to work. But the bigger question is, who does this benefit? Does it benefit corporate landlords? Does it benefit a couple of developers? There's no clear reasoning that underlies it, and the government hasn't actually asked for any kind of consultation to figure out what's needed and what would work best.
I want to dig into a couple of things you said there. First, I'll just say for our listeners, a little bit of what Premier Ford has said. He said it's about getting business back to business as usual, and quote, like every other normal citizen, you go out there and you show up 5 days a week, unquote. You know, this is about collaboration in the office, all those sorts of things. How do you respond to what the Premier has said?
Well, I think every normal person knows that we've been working in wherever possible hybrid and remote work situations for several years now.
And he's not saying they're not working. He's saying they should work in the office, like a lot of other
sectors.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to suggest is that most of us have been working in spaces wherever we can that have been hybrid and remote work possibilities because we're in 2026, quite frankly. And sometimes it makes more sense to work remotely or work in a hybrid environment. It helps with traffic congestion. It helps with productivity. It helps support local businesses in the communities where people are living while they're working. But what it doesn't do is fill corporate spaces in downtown Toronto and other cities. What you have is a situation of no consultation about what works for the workers. There's been no demonstrated impact, negative impact on service provision to Ontarians. So this seems to be a solution that's looking for a problem.
What kind of impact do you foresee for people who are telling you they really rely on having that one day or two at home?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're going to see is when you're able to work in a hybrid or flex work environment, you're able to participate in your community more, you're able to pay more attention to your family, your kids. We've seen studies that have shown that productivity actually goes up for workers when they have that kind of flexibility wherever it's possible. So what I think you're going to see, particularly in the GTA, is, and I'm not suggesting Toronto is the center of the universe by any measure, but you're going to see congestion on the 401. You're going to see congestion downtown. You're going to see, you know, people who are wasting time in commuting that they could be spending actually contributing positively either in their work environment or with their family and communities. So I think, you know, when we know we live in a world now where hybrid and remote work are possible, and people have come up with incredibly creative ways to remain in contact, it doesn't make any sense to harken back to some father knows best era that requires, you know, 9 to 5 around the water cooler. That doesn't exist anymore.
Are there concerns, though, that and I don't know if there are, I'm asking if the province or anyone has raised concerns about deliverables, people not meeting their deadlines or monitoring of people working from home, that they want them to come back to the office?
There has been zero evidence presented of that. As a matter of fact, there's nothing that the government has suggested is wrong with how people are working right now. This seems to be, more of a kind of nostalgic look back at what they believe work should look like versus what work has evolved to become.
Do you worry, though, that at this point there won't be a lot of sympathy for government workers who have privileges that many in the private sector do not have?
Oh, I don't. This isn't about looking for sympathy. I just want to be very clear on this. I think that what we're looking at is, does this make sense? And if there's a problem that needs to be solved, you don't use a sledgehammer to drive a nail. Right. So if there's an issue with a particular sector or a particular ministry or a particular job classification, then let's talk about that. This has never been about shake our fist at the clouds. This is about what makes sense in building a very strong Ontario public service. My members are very proud of the work they do and the jobs they do in supporting Ontarians, and they want to have good conditions to be able to do that in. So this isn't about looking for sympathy. This is about, and I would say that the question for private industry is the same. How do you recruit and retain talent when you know that there are possibilities for remote work that exist, but you're denying people that opportunity?
Not everybody sees it that way, though, as you know, right? So I was just talking to people about this, working in different industries. It just came up in dinner conversation, and, you know, one person hates the idea ever, they work in a creative industry, hates the idea of ever having to potentially go into an office. Another one can't imagine a reality where their life at work and their home life are not separated. So I'm sure you have the diversity of opinion within your membership as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's why we're saying the blanket mandate is the wrong approach. If there are people that prefer to work 5 days in the office, then for sure, why wouldn't that be an option for them? So, you know, is my mom used to say, that's why they make chocolate and vanilla. And in this case, I think we have a situation in which flexible work is, if it's possible in the type of work that people are doing, why isn't it an option?
JP, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks so much.
JP Hornick is president of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union. We reached them in Toronto. Minnesota was in the news quite a bit in 2025, but Governor Tim Walz is hoping to leave those headlines in the past. The state's social services system has been mired in scandal after widespread fraud was uncovered. Prosecutors say members of the Somali diaspora were largely responsible for the scheme, where hundreds of millions of dollars were stolen from a government program meant to keep children fed during the pandemic. President Donald Trump immediately homed in on it, threatening to cut off federal funding and targeting Somalis in the state. Today, the governor and former candidate for vice president explained why all that has led him to the decision not to seek a third term.
A single taxpayer dollar wasted on fraud should be intolerable. And while there's a role to play for everyone, from the legislature to prosecutors to insurance companies to local and county government, the buck does stop with me. My administration has been taking fast, decisive action to solve this crisis. We'll win the fight against the fraudsters. But the political gamesmanship we're seeing from Republicans is only making that fight harder. We've got Republicans here in the state legislature playing hide and seek with potential whistleblowers. We've got conspiracy theorist right-wing YouTubers breaking into our daycares, demanding access to our children. We've got the President of the United States demonizing our Somali neighbors and wrongfully confiscating funds that Minnesotans rely on. These opportunists are willing to hurt our people to score cheap points. They and their allies have no intention of helping us solve this problem, and every intention of trying to profit off of it. Which brings me to this. 2026 is an election year. Election years have a way of ramping up the politics at a time when we simply can't afford more of that in Minnesota. In September, I announced that I would seek a historic third term as Minnesota's governor, and I have every confidence that if I gave it my all, we would win the race. But as I reflect on this moment with my family and my team over the holidays, I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all. Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who want to prey on our differences. So I've decided to step out of this race, and I'll let others worry about the election while I focus on the work that's in front of me for the next year. I'm passing on this race with zero sadness and zero regret. I did not run for this job to have the job. I ran for the job to do the job. Minnesota faces enormous challenges this year, and I refuse to spend a single minute doing anything other than rising to meet this moment.
From earlier today, that was Minnesota Governor Tim Walz announcing that he will not seek a third term amid a fraud scandal in the state.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard right across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nina Cooksall. Take care.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. I'm your volunteer host this evening for On the River from 7 to 10 p.m. It's Michelle Bedford. And first up, let's get the weather going for you. We've got patchy fog with clouds, highs 27 to 32, overnight lows 15 to 20 with a dense fog advisory until noon tomorrow, chance of freezing rain, and reduced visibility.